measuring radioactivity in a human body for the first time. In so doing, they determined that Lehman had died from radium poisoning. His remains were saturated with radioactivity. As Martland and von Terhotsky worked together, von Terhotsky asked the medical examiner to help the dial painters. Kniff made a similar appeal. And so, only a day or so after Lehman had died, Martland found himself in St. Mary's Hospital meeting a brave young woman called Marguerite Carlo. She lay weakly in her hospital bed, her shockingly pale face surrounded by limp, dark hair. At this time, her palate had so eroded that it opened into her nasal passages. Also visiting Marguerite was her sister, Sarah Myleffer. Sarah was no longer quite as matronly in figure as she had once been. She had been losing weight for the past year or so. It was the worry, she thought. Worry for Marguerite, who was so badly ill. Worry for her daughter, who was now 14 years old. Like most mothers, she rarely worried about herself. A week ago, she'd noticed that she'd started to bruise easily. And it was more than that, if she was honest with herself. Large black and blue spots had broken out all over her body. She'd come to see Marguerite anyway, not wanting to miss the visit, limping up the stairs with her walking cane, even though she felt very weak. Her teeth were aching, too, but you had to put things into perspective. Look at her sister. She was far worse off. Even when her gums started to bleed, Sarah thought only of her sister, who was so close to death. As Martland met the Carlo girls, he observed that although Marguerite was more ill than Sarah, Sarah was also not well. When he asked her, she confessed that the black and blue spots were causing her intense pain. Martland ran tests and found Sarah to be very anemic. He told her the results, spoke with her about her jaw trouble. And then Sarah, perhaps finally worried over what it might mean, went bad quite rapidly and had to be admitted to the hospital. But at least she wasn't alone. She and Marguerite shared a hospital room, two sisters together, facing whatever might lie ahead. The hospital doctors examined Sarah closely, concerned at her decline. Her face was swollen on the left side, her glands hot and tender. She was running a temperature of 102.2 degrees, increasing up to 105.8 degrees in the evenings, and by now had marked lesions in her mouth. She was, it appeared, profoundly toxic. Martland wanted to test the two women to see if radium was the cause of their illnesses, but the only tests he knew, those he had conducted with von Terhotsky and Barker, required burning bone to ash. You couldn't very well do that with living patients. It was von Terhotsky who came up with the answer. If the women were radioactive, all they had to do was devise some tests to prove it. These tests, which would be honed and largely invented by Martland and von Terhotsky, were created specifically to test the dial painters' bodies. No physician had ever attempted to test living patients in this way before. Later, Martland would discover that a specialist had done something similar before him, but in June 1925, with the clock running down on Marguerite Carlo, he innovated the tests, knowing nothing of the other scientists' work. He was, indeed, a man of extraordinary talents. The pair devised two methods. The gamma ray test, which involved sitting the patient before an electroscope to read the gamma radiation coming from the skeleton, and the expired air method, whereby the patient blew through a series of bottles into an electroscope so that the amount of radon could be measured. This latter was born from the idea that, as radium decayed into the gas radon, if radium was present in the girl's jawbones, the toxic gas might be exhaled as they breathed out. The doctors took their equipment to the hospital to try on Marguerite. But when they got there, it was Sarah Mileffer they decided to test first. Being in the hospital had not helped her. Despite being given a blood transfusion on June 14th, Sarah had become so ill she'd had to be removed from the room she shared with her sister. When Marguerite asked where she was, the nurses told her Sarah had been removed to receive special treatments. That was true, in a way. The tests Sarah was about to have were special, for she was the first dial painter ever to be tested for the presence of radium, the first who would prove whether or not all that conjecture was correct. This was the moment of truth. In a hospital room in St. Mary's, Martland and von Serhotsky set up the equipment. They first tested Sarah's body. As she lay weakly on the bed, Martland held the electrometer 18 inches above her chest to test her bones. A normal leak would be 10 subdivisions in 60 minutes. Sarah's body was leaking 14 subdivisions in the same time. Radium. Next, they tested her breath. The normal result they were looking for was 5 subdivisions in 30 minutes. This test wasn't as easy as simply holding the measuring device over Sarah's prone body, though. This test she had to help with. It was very hard for her to do because she was so unwell. The patient was in a dying, almost moribund condition, remembered Martland. Sarah found it difficult to breathe properly. She couldn't for 5 minutes' time. Sarah was a fighter. It's not clear if she knew what the tests were for, whether she had the capacity at that stage even to know what was going on around her. But when Martland asked her to breathe into his machine, she tried so very, very hard for him. In, out. In, out. She kept it going, even as her pulse raced and her gums bled and her gammy leg ached and ached. In, out. In, out. Sarah Mileffer breathed. She lay back on the pillows, exhausted, spent, and the doctors checked the results. The subdivisions were 15.4. With every breath she gave, the radium was there, carried on the very air, slipping out through her painful mouth, passing by her aching teeth, moving like a whisper across her tongue. Radium. Sarah Mileffer was a fighter. But there are some fights that you cannot win. The doctors left her in the hospital that day on June 16, 1925. They didn't see as her septic condition increased, as new bruises bloomed on her body, blood vessels bursting under her skin. Her mouth would not stop bleeding, pus oozed from her gums. Her bad leg was a constant source of pain. Everything was a constant source of pain. She couldn't take it anymore. She became delirious and lost her mind. But it didn't take too long, not after that. In the early hours of June 18th, only a week after she'd been admitted to hospital, Sarah Mileffer died. The same day, Martland conducted an autopsy. The results would take some weeks to come back. He was bound by no promises of secrecy this time. He spoke to the media on the day Sarah died, as they gathered to hear of this latest death. "I have nothing more than my suspicions now," he told them. "We are going to take the bones and some of the organs of Mrs. Mylefer's body, reduce them to ashes, and make extensive laboratory tests with the most delicate instruments available for radioactive substances." And then he continued, probably striking fear into the hearts of Sarah's former employers, "This poisoning, if my suspicions are correct, is so insidious and sometimes takes so long to manifest itself that I think it possible it has been going on for some time throughout the country without being discovered." That time was now at an end, although Martland wasn't rushing into anything. "We have nothing more definite than a theory at present," he said. "I will not make the statement that commercial radium poisoning exists until we can prove it." But the implication was, once he could. The press were all over it. Sarah's death even made the front page of the New York Times. Yet, while the whole world knew of her passing, there was someone who didn't. Her little sister, Marguerite. She hadn't seen Sarah since June 15th, the night she'd been taken from their shared room. She'd inquired several times as to how her sister was. Even though Marguerite had seen Sarah decline, she must have had hope. Sarah had always been the strong one, once Marguerite had sickened, and she had only been seriously ill for a few days. The nurses put her off when she asked after her big sister. But on June 18th, when the papers were filled with the news of Sarah's death, Marguerite had innocently asked to see a newspaper. "No," the nurses said, wanting to spare her. "Why?" asked Marguerite. Of course, Marguerite Carlo would ask why. And so the nurses told her of her sister's death. "She is said to have borne the news bravely, and expressed regret that she could not be present at the funeral. She was far too ill to go." It was Sarah's father, Stephen, who told the authorities of his daughter's death, who arranged her funeral, who looked after her teenage daughter, Marguerite. It was he who watched her coffin being lowered into the ground at Laurel Grove Cemetery shortly after 2 o'clock p.m. on Saturday, June 20th. Sarah may have been 35, but it was his little girl who'd gone. 19. Sarah wasn't even in her grave before her former company was denying it was to blame. Veit gave a statement to the press. "There was small possibility," he said, "of the existence of a radium poison menace." Speaking of the newly appointed Dr. Flynn, the USRC-employed company doctor, he revealed, "We have engaged persons of the greatest reliability and reputation to conduct an investigation." He told the press that Sarah had been examined by the Life Extension Institute while working for the company and, perpetuating the position taken back in June 1924, when the firm had chosen to ignore the unpublished Drinker report, revealed that "nothing was found in our plant not found among average industrial employees." It was, he said, absurd to think the same condition could have caused the deaths of Dr. Lehman and Sarah Mylefer. The latter could not have handled in 100 years of her work half the amount of radium Dr. Lehman handled in 1 year. The amounts handled by Sarah were so infinitesimal that, in the opinion of company officials, the work could not be considered as hazardous. Yet, those infinitesimal amounts still left a trace, something that Martland was discovering. Sarah's autopsy was conducted 9 hours after her death. She was the first ever dial painter to be autopsied, the first radium girl to have an expert examine every inch of her body for clues as to what could have caused her mysterious downfall. The medical detective made notes as he moved down her silent corpse, working from head to toe. He stretched her mouth wide, looked inside. It was filled with old, dark, clotted blood. He inspected her left leg, the one she'd been limping on for 3 years. It was, the doctor noted, 4 centimeters shorter than her right. He weighed and measured her internal organs, stripped out her bones to run his tests. He looked inside those bones, into the bone marrow, where the blood-producing centers lay. In a healthy adult, the bone marrow is usually yellow and fatty. Sarah had dark red marrow throughout the entire shaft. Martland was a medical man. He had seen for himself the application of radium to treat cancers in hospital, and he knew how that worked. Radium had 3 types of rays that it constantly emitted, alpha, beta, and gamma rays. The alpha ray was a very short ray and could be cut off by a thin layer of paper. A beta ray, which had a little greater penetrating power, could be cut off by a sheet of lead. Modern science says a sheet of aluminum. The gamma ray was very penetrating, and it was by its gamma ray, a radium expert said, you might say it is magic. For the gamma radiation was what gave radium its medicinal value, being able to travel through the body and be directed at a tumor. It was the gamma and beta rays the lab workers protected themselves against with their lead aprons. They didn't need to worry about the alpha rays, as they could do no harm, being unable to penetrate skin. That was just as well, for alpha rays, which formed 95% of the total rays, were physiologically and biologically intensely more irritating than beta or gamma rays. In other words, the worst kind of radiation. In Sarah Mileffer's body, Martland now realized, the alpha rays had not been blocked by a thin sheet of paper or by skin. They were not blocked by anything. The radium was in the very heart of her bones, in close proximity to her bone marrow, which was constantly bombarded by rays from the radioactive deposits. The distance, Martland later said, is approximately 1/100 of an inch from the blood-forming centers. There was no escaping this most dangerous poison. Given the extreme power of the alpha rays, those whirling, powerful, invisible forces, the uses of which we do not yet understand, as von Serhatsky had once written, Martland now realized that it didn't matter that the amount of radium Sarah had worked with was infinitesimal. From the tests, the doctor estimated that her body contained 180 micrograms of radium. A tiny amount. But it was enough. It was a type of radiation never before known to have occurred in human beings. He continued his tests, and now he discovered something that no one had ever appreciated before. For he didn't just test Sarah's affected jaw and teeth for radioactivity, the site of all the Dial Painter's necroses. He tested her organs. He tested her bones. They were all radioactive. Her spleen was radioactive. Her liver, her gammy left leg. He found it all over her, but chiefly in her bones, with her legs and jaw having considerable radioactivity. They were the parts most affected, just as her symptoms had shown. It was an extremely important discovery. Dr. Humphreys, in Orange, had never connected the cases he had seen because the women presented different complaints. Why would he have thought that Grace Fryer's aching back might be connected to Jenny Stalker's peculiar knee or Quinta McDonald's arthritic hip. But it was the same thing affecting all the girls. It was radium, heading straight for their bones, yet on its way, seeming to decide, almost on a whim, where to settle in the greatest degree. And so, some women felt the pain first in their feet. In others, it was in their jaw. In others, still, their spine. It had totally foxed their doctors. But it was the same cause in all of them. In all of them, it was the radium. There was one final test that Martland now conducted. I then took from Mrs. Mylefer, he remembered, portions of the femur and other bones, and placed dental films over them. I strapped the films all over her bones at various places, and left them in a dark room in a box. When he'd tried this experiment on normal bones, leaving the films in place for 3 or 4 months, he had not got the slightest photographic impression. Within 60 hours, Sarah's bones caused exposure on the film, white, fog-like patches against the ebony black. Just as the girl's glow had once done as they walked home through the streets of Orange after work, her bones had made a picture, an eerie, shining light against the dark. And from that strange, white fog, Martland now understood another critical concept. Sarah was dead, but her bones seemed very much alive, making impressions on photographic plates, carelessly emitting measurable radioactivity. It was all due, of course, to the radium. Sarah's own life may have been cut short, but the radium inside her had a half-life of 1,600 years. It would be shooting out its rays from Sarah's bones for centuries, long after she was gone. Even though it had killed her, it kept on bombarding her body every day, every week, month after month, year after year. It is bombarding her body to this day. Martland paused in his work, thinking hard, thinking not just of Sarah, but of her sister, Marguerite, and of all the other girls he had seen in Barry's office, thinking of the fact that, as he later said, there is nothing known to science that will eliminate, change, or neutralize these radium deposits. Radium is indestructible, Dr. Kniff concurred. You can subject it to fire for days, weeks, or months without it being affected in the least. He went on to make the damning connection. If this is the case, how can we expect to get it out of the human body? For years, the girls had been searching for a diagnosis, for someone to tell them what was wrong. Once they had that, they believed, faithfully, then the doctors would be able to cure them. But radium poisoning, Martland now knew, was utterly incurable. Following the results of his tests, Martland shared the proven cause of Sarah's death. "There is not the slightest doubt," he wrote, "that she died of an acute anemia following the ingestion of luminous paint." As hers was the first properly tested case, it became of considerable interest to medical men. Dr. Flynn, the company doctor, immediately wrote to Martland, "Would it be possible for me to get a section of Mrs. Mylefer's tissues so I can compare them with those of my laboratory animals, which I am expecting to kill sometime in the next few weeks?" Dr. Drinker, too, followed the progress of the case with great interest. He had not finished his fight with USRC, because Arthur Roeder had not kept his word. It was the company lawyer, Josiah Stryker, who had handled the delicate matter of the Drinker report and the Department of Labor. He had taken the report to Roach, but refused to let him retain a copy. "It will be available to you," he said airily to Roach, "at any time in my office." Stryker had left with the report in hand. He added as he went, "If the department insist on having a copy in their own file, I will provide one." Well, the department had insisted, but the company sent it to McBride, Roach's boss, the man who had been furious when tenacious Catherine Wiley had intervened in the Dial Painters cases and rebuked Roach as a result, and not to Roach himself. When Drinker found out, he was furious. On the day Sarah Mileffer died, he wrote to Roeder, "I am arranging for the immediate publication of my report." He was, as the saying goes, planning to publish and be damned. But Stryker was quick with his response, "Publish and be sued." Yet if Roeder and Stryker thought they had Drinker pegged, they had thought wrong. One of Drinker's brothers happened to be a good corporation lawyer. The doctor asked him what he thought of the firm's threat, and the brother said to tell him to sue and be damned. So Drinker called their bluff. The Drinker Report, first filed on June 3, 1924, would finally be published in August 1925, with a press date of May 25th, 5 days before Hoffman had first read his study, in order to give Drinker precedence on the discovery of the link between the girl's illnesses and the radioactive paint. Whatever date they put on it, it was published well over a year after being submitted to USRC. Commentators on the case later said, "This report by the Harvard investigators was a scientific document of the greatest importance, not only to remedy conditions in this plant, but to acquaint other manufacturers using the same radium formula with its toxicity and potentially lethal effects. Science and humanity alike demanded immediate publication of this report, but it was resolutely suppressed." The company had tried to keep everyone in the dark. The Department of Labor, the medical community, the women they had doomed to die. But the light, finally, was flooding in now. The momentum was building for the women's cause, even as radium's supporters tried to throw it off track. And Martland, the girl's illustrious medical champion, was first in the firing line as pro-radiumites sought to undermine his credibility. William Bailey, the man behind the Radithor tonic, remarked, cuttingly, "Doctors who have never had the slightest experience with radium and know no more about it than a schoolboy have been trying to garner some publicity by claiming harmful effects. Their statements are perfectly ridiculous." Bailey added that he would happily take in one dose all the radium used in the factory in 1 month. USRC, too, was quick to step in, with a spokesman saying dismissively, "Radium, because of the mystery which surrounds much of its activities, is a topic which stimulates the imagination, and it is probably this rather than actual fact that has caused the outcry." Roeder weighed into the debate, claiming publicly that many of the women were unfit when they started dial painting, and as an excuse had unfairly impugned the firm. It wasn't even the female victims alone that USRC attacked. A spokesman said that Lehman, the chief chemist who had died, was not in robust health when he began with radium work. Yet the momentum that had begun and was now building, first with Hoffman's report, then Sarah's sacrifice, and now the Drinker report, too, was unstoppable. Even the commissioner of the Department of Labor, Andrew McBride, who had previously seemed reluctant to intervene, now beat the drum of change. He made a personal visit to the Orange studio and asked why the Drinker's safety recommendations had not been put into effect. He was informed that the firm did not agree with them all. Many of them had already been followed, and some were impractical. McBride wasn't swayed. Now he said that he believed that human life is far too important to be neglected or wasted if it is possible to conserve it. Consequently, he declared that if the firm did not carry out the drinker's suggestions, I would issue orders to close their factory. I would compel them to comply or close, no matter at what cost. For those who had long supported the girls, it was a complete turnaround. Carl Quimby, the priest who had offered spiritual comfort to Hazel Kuzer, was relieved to observe that, at last, someone in authority was finally taking note. Seeing Dr. Martland's findings reported widely in the Eastern press, he felt moved to write to him, "I can scarcely express to you how gratified I am that you are doing this splendid thing. I am wishing you every success and assuring you of the appreciation of a goodly number of people." But it was, of course, the dial painters themselves for whom the biggest difference was made. Soon after Sarah passed away, Martland carried his testing equipment back into St. Mary's. It was Marguerite Carlo's turn to be measured for the radium that the doctor believed was lurking in her bones. She was in a terrible condition on the day he ran the tests, with her mouth, as it had always been, the thing that was most agonizing. The alpha rays of the radium, Martland now believed, were slowly drilling those holes into her jawbone. Despite the pain, Marguerite put the breathing tube into her mouth and blew. Just as her sister had done before her, she breathed as steadily as she possibly could. In. Out. On the day Martland ran her tests, the normal leak was 8.5 subdivisions in 50 minutes. The normal number changed depending on the humidity and other factors. When he checked Marguerite's results, they showed 99.7 subdivisions in the same time. At least, she thought, it would help her legal case. She had more reason than ever to want to win now. Following her sister's death, the Carlos had added Sarah's claim to the litigation. USRC was now fighting three cases for Marguerite, Hazel, and Sarah. Marguerite was the only one of those three left alive, and so she wanted to do everything she could to help the case, not only for herself, but for her sister. That was something to live for, to strive for, to battle through the pain for. While she was in St. Mary's, her lawyer, Isidore Kalich of Kalich and Kalich, interviewed her even as she lay in bed, taking her formal testimony so that, whatever happened, he had it to fight the girl's case. Yet, Hazel, Sarah, and Marguerite weren't the only girls afflicted. That was something Martland knew, but what he didn't know was how to contact the others, to get more girls to come forward. Some were ultimately connected to him by their dentists and physicians, but others came to him via a young woman by the name of Catherine Wiley. In the midst of my difficulties in the summer of 1925, Miss Wiley again called at our home. This time she was interested in my own case, for she had heard that I had been ill, Catherine Sharb later recalled. She suggested that I consult the county medical examiner for an exact diagnosis. Catherine had been troubled by her ailments for a long time by that stage. She had seen what had happened to Irene. She had read what had happened to Sarah. She wasn't stupid. She knew why Miss Wiley had called on her, and what Dr. Martland thought he would find. To her sister, Josephine, she said slowly, "It must be that I have radium poisoning. She tried it out in her mind, like slipping on a new dress. It clung to her, skin tight, nowhere to hide. It felt most peculiar, not least because Catherine was doing well that summer. She did not appear ill any more. Her jaw wasn't troubling her. All the infections in her mouth had cleared up. Her stomach, following her operation, was much improved. Her general physique was good. She couldn't have what the others had. She couldn't, for they had all died, and here she was, still living. Yet there was only one way to be sure. There was only one way to know. Catherine Sharb duly made an appointment with the county physician. She wasn't the only one. Quinta MacDonald had become increasingly concerned about her own condition of late. Her teeth, which she had once considered her best feature, had started loosening in her mouth and then falling out spontaneously, straight into her hand. Ironically, her daughter Helen was losing her milk teeth at the same time. "I can stand the pain," Quinta later said, "but I do hate to lose my teeth. The upper ones are so loose they merely hang." Following her new trouble, Quinta had started consulting Dr. Kniff, the kind dentist who had treated her sister Molly. Kniff had been working with Martland to treat Marguerite, so it was Kniff who arranged for Quinta to have Martland's special tests. And with her came her old friend Grace Fryer, who now had no jaw trouble at all, who was apparently in good health, but whose back hurt worse with every passing day. One by one they came. Catherine, Quinta, Grace. They weren't ill like Sarah or Marguerite or Dr. Lehman. They weren't at death's door. They stayed still as Martland scanned their bodies with his electrometer, asked them to breathe into a tube, tested them for the telltale anemia that would betray what was happening inside their bones. To each he said the same. "He told me," Grace remembered, "that my system showed the presence of radioactive substances." "He told me," Quinta said, "that my trouble was all due to the presence of radium." "He told them that there was no cure." A deep breath was needed for that news. In. Out. "When I first found out what I had," Grace remembered, "and learned that it was incurable." She trailed off, but eventually continued. "I was horror-stricken. I would look at people I knew, and I would say to myself, 'Well, I'll never see you again.'" They all had that same thought. Quinta, heading home to her children, "I'll never see you again." Catherine, breaking the news to her father, "I'll never see you again." For Catherine, though, the diagnosis brought relief, too. "The doctors told me that my tests showed positive radioactivity," she remembered. "I was not as frightened as I thought I would be. At least there was no groping in the dark now. Instead, there was light, glowing, glorious light, shining, stunning light, light that led their way into the future." "The county medical examiner's diagnosis," commented Catherine Sharb with characteristic acumen, "furnished perfect legal evidence for a lawsuit." For too long, the women had waited for the truth. The scales at last were tipping against the company. The girls had been given a death sentence, yet they had also been given the tools to fight their cause, to fight for justice. "The diagnosis," Catherine Sharb now said, "gave me hope." Part 2. Power. 20. There was much to be done. Even before the summer was out, Dr. Martland had lent his voice to Catherine Wiley's campaign to amend the industrial compensation law. Yet the legal change was only part of it, for the girls, who now understood how unforgivably careless the company had been with their lives, the real question was how the firm's executives could have considered them expendable. Why didn't their basic humanity compel them to end the practice of lip-pointing? Grace Fryer, for one, was filled with anger as her clever mind raked over what had happened, for she now recalled all too well a fleeting moment in her memory that sealed the company's guilt. "Do not do that," Sabin von Zerhotsky had once said to her. "You will get sick." 7 years later, here she was in Newark City Hospital. Now she realized von Zerhotsky had known. He had known all along. But if he had, why had he let them slowly kill themselves with every dial they painted? Grace had an opportunity to put that question to the man himself, immediately. For when Martland tested her and Quinta for radioactivity in July 1925, he wasn't the only doctor present. Von Zerhotsky sat quietly beside the technical equipment as the girls were told that they were going to die. And as Grace listened to the words fall from Martland's mouth, "All your trouble, presence of radioactive substances," the memory of that warning came rushing into her mind. Still reeling from the news, Grace, nonetheless, jutted out her chin with archetypal resolve and looked levelly at her former boss. "Why didn't you tell us?" she asked, simply. Von Zerhotsky must have bowed his head. He stuttered out something about being aware of these dangers, and said he had warned other members of the corporation without avail. Earlier that year he'd told Hoffman that he endeavored to remedy the situation but was opposed by members of the corporation who had charge of the personnel. He now said to Grace, "The matter was not in my jurisdiction but Mr. Roeder's. Since the matter was under his supervision, I could do nothing." Well, there was nothing the girls could do now about their fatal illness, that was for sure. And there was nothing von Zerhotsky could do about his. For he also blew into the machines that he and Martland had devised that summer, perhaps just out of interest, or perhaps with deep suspicion, for he had not been well. Von Zerhotsky's breath, as it turned out, contained more radiation than anyone they had tested so far. From the very start, Grace bore her diagnosis bravely. She had a courageous spirit and refused to let Martland's prognosis affect her life. She had always loved her life, and, if anything, she now valued it even more highly. So she tucked the diagnosis away in her mind, and then carried on. She didn't stop work. She didn't change her habits. She kept swimming. She kept socializing with her friends. And she kept on going to the theater. "I don't believe in giving up," was what she said. As for Quinta, like her friend Grace, she was said to have borne the news with a brave and smiling demeanor, far worse than her own diagnosis. In the mind of a kind-hearted woman like Quinta, was seeing her friends suffer. She often worried, remembered her sister-in-law, Ethel Breelitz, because the others were similarly afflicted. At least she had the steadfast Dr. Kniff to help her with her treatment. Quinta's teeth grew worse over the summer, and she relied on Kniff's attentions more and more. Almost as soon as they'd received the news, Grace, Quinta, and Catherine Sharb hoped to bring a lawsuit against USRC in order to get some help with their crippling medical bills. Knowing that Marguerite Carlo had successfully done so earlier that year, they hoped that it would be straightforward. Isidore Kalich, Marguerite's lawyer, was the obvious place to start their fight for justice. Quinta made the first appointment to see him. With some trepidation, for she had never done anything like this before, she limped into his office and outlined her case. He listened carefully, and then broke bad news. Her action was barred by the statute of limitations. The new girls had run into an old problem. The Workmen's Compensation Bureau, where the company wanted the existing cases heard, had a 5-month statute of limitations in New Jersey. Marguerite, who had filed suit about 13 months after she'd left USRC, was thus going through the federal court, which had a more generous 2-year statute. That was well matched for Marguerite, for she'd stayed with the company long after the other girls had left, so when she first became ill, she was still an employee. But Quinta hadn't worked for the firm since February 1919. She was now trying to start a lawsuit more than 6 years later. 4 years too late, according to the law, even though her symptoms hadn't started until 1923, and she hadn't received a diagnosis of radium poisoning until a few weeks ago. But the law cared nothing for the fact that this brand new disease took several years to manifest. The law was the law, and it said neither Quinta, nor Grace, nor Catherine had any recourse to justice, or, at least, that was the interpretation of Isidore Kalich. It fell to Quinta to tell the others what he'd said. Nothing could be done. It was galling news for them all. "When I realize," said Grace Fryer, "that I am paying for something that someone else is to blame for..." Grace now tried another lawyer, Henry Gottfried, with whom she'd already had some dealings, but Gottfried told her that the case would take considerable money to develop. He said he could do nothing for her unless she gave him cash up front. "But I had no money," remembered Grace in frustration, "for I was compelled constantly to attend doctors. I felt very badly, yet lawyers did not seem to be interested in the matter without a fee." Part of the reluctance of attorneys to take the case was undoubtedly due to the power of the United States Radium Corporation. For not only were the legal issues potentially insurmountable, but the girl's opponent in court would be a hugely wealthy, well-connected company with government contacts and the financial resources to eke out the fight for as long as it took. Said Catherine Sharb, "Each of the other attorneys to whom I appealed felt that it was hopeless to try to collect damages from the radium company." Another problem, too, was just how new the disease was. Given the longevity of the radium therapeutics industry, could it really be true that radium had hurt the girls? Perhaps, as Roeder had said, the girls were trying to palm off something on the firm. Now the effects of the company's suppression of the drinker report really made themselves felt. Thanks to that concealment, published studies on the link between radium and the women's illnesses had been available for only a matter of weeks. None of the lawyers had ever heard of radium poisoning. No one knew anything about it. No one, that is, except for Harrison Martland. Martland was in direct contact with the girls over that summer, offering what assistance he could, and one day Catherine Sharb came to his lab to discuss something very important. She had always wanted to write. Well, now she and Martland wrote something together. Though its topic was macabre, In time, it would come to have its own name. The List of the Doomed. Martland wrote it out on the back of a blank autopsy report. He sketched out a series of penciled lines to create a neat chart, and then picked up his fountain pen and wrote, in flowing black ink, on Catherine's direction, 1. Helen Quinlan. 2. Miss Molly Maggia. 3. Miss Irene Rudolph. 4. Mrs. Hazel Couser. 5. Mrs. Myleffer. 6. Miss Marguerite Carlo. The list went on and on. Slowly, methodically, Catherine supplied him with as many names as she could recall, those girls she knew were ill or had died, as well as those who weren't yet sick. She recalled some 50 former co-workers whose names she gave to Martland. In the years to come, the doctor was said to retrieve the list from his files whenever he heard of the death of a dial painter. With chilling prescience, he would find her name on the list, written there back in the summer of 1925, and meticulously write a neat red D beside the woman's name. D is for death. Catherine was, at that time, in fair health, but as her formal diagnosis sank in, she found that she could not stop thinking about that prediction. D is for death. She had already been made nervous by Irene's passing. Now every ache became a symptom that could lead to her own sudden death. "I know I am going to die," she said. She stressed it, trying it on for size. Die? Die! It doesn't seem right. When she looked in the mirror these days, it wasn't the same Catherine who stared back at her anymore. Her face, once usually pretty, a newspaper wrote of her at this time, is now pinched and drawn with suffering. The suspense and worry have undermined her spirit. That was the thing, the worry. It put her in a very precarious mental condition. Her former company, keeping tabs on her, put it more harshly. They called her mentally deranged. "When you're sick and can't get around much," Catherine herself said, "things are different. Your friends aren't the same to you. They're nice to you and all that, but you're not one of them. I get so discouraged sometimes that I wish... well, I don't wish pleasant things." She became very badly ill and consulted a nerve specialist countless times. But Dr. Beeling couldn't stop her spiral of thoughts, nor halt that flickering cinereal of ghost girls still playing in her head. Catherine had always been lively and sociable before, but now, her sister said, she is not the same girl at all. She has completely changed in temperament. Catherine's periods stopped. She couldn't eat. Her features themselves seemed almost to change, with her eyes becoming larger and more bug-like, as though sticking out on stalks. That was what happened when you stared your own death in the face. She murmured, "Night and rainy days are the worst times." Before the year was out, Catherine Sharb would be confined in a hospital for nervous disorders. It was little wonder, given the trauma she could see her friends enduring. The surprise was that more dial painters weren't similarly afflicted. These days, visitors to Marguerite Carlo in St. Mary's Hospital found her much the same. Her blood was almost white, and her blood count only 20%. A normal reading would be 100%. This was only just compatible with life. But it was her head, her face. Her x-rays now showed that the radium had eaten away her lower jaw to a mere stump. just as he'd experienced with Molly Maggia, Kniff found himself helpless to stop the rot. Another patient at St. Mary's that August of 1925 was Albina Maggia Larice, but for much happier reasons. Her stomach bloomed with pregnancy, her cheeks flushed with pride. For nearly 4 years, she and James had been trying for a child. Each month that had passed without the good news she yearned for had left a bitter taste in her mouth, as her body betrayed her time and again. Next month, she would tell herself, but then next month had always brought the same acidic disappointment. Not any more. At long last, Albina thought contentedly, rubbing a loving hand across her swollen belly, she was becoming a mother. She would cradle her child in her arms, tuck it into bed at night, keep it safe from harm. When the pains had started, she'd made her way to St. Mary's. Albina was clutching her stomach, trying to keep from crying out. It was strange, but somehow, even though she didn't know how this was supposed to feel, somehow, in some way, something felt wrong. It just felt wrong. The doctors put her in a room, laid her down on a bed. She pushed and pushed when they told her to. She felt the baby move through her, felt it as her baby came, her son. She felt him, but Albina never heard him cry. Her baby was born dead. 21. Albina Larice didn't suffer from the same aching pains as her sister Quinta, the arthritic hips, the loose teeth. She'd once had a rheumatic knee shortly before she'd married James, but, she said, I got rid of that. It never bothered me anymore. Yet just 2 weeks after her baby was stillborn at St. Mary's, as though her body was breaking to match her heart, severe pain appeared in her limbs, and her left leg began to shorten. In October 1925, as her family doctor's treatment had brought no relief, Albina consulted Dr. Humphreys at the orthopedic hospital. It was there, as she overheard the doctors talking about her, that she heard one of them remark that she was a radium case. It was shock after shock, trouble after trouble. I am, Albina later said, so unhappy. As the doctors had done with Quinta, they encased her in plaster for 4 months, hoping it would help her improve. But Albina didn't feel any benefit. I know, she murmured dejectedly. I'm getting weaker, weaker, weaker. Along the corridor from her in the hospital was another former dial painter, Edna Hussman. The girl, once nicknamed the Dresden Doll, had been seeing doctors since September 1925, apparently for rheumatism. When their treatments didn't help, she'd sought out Humphreys. Her trouble had begun back in July. I first started, she later said, with these here pains in my hip. When I would be walking, I would get these sharp pains, and I would stumble. It happened nearly every time I would walk. I just limped along, held on to different things around the house to get around. That is the only way I could get around. Humphreys, who noted that Edna's left leg was an inch shorter than her right, took an X-ray. Edna had walked to the hospital with the help of her husband, Louis, so he didn't think she could be too badly hurt. But when he assessed the picture, he had to think again. Her leg was broken. She'd broken her leg when she stumbled. Yet, since the stumble was a slight stumble and not a fall, she had not realized she was so badly injured. Humphreys remembered of Edna's case. She had a spontaneous fracture of the neck of the femur, thigh bone, and that doesn't occur in young people as a rule. I have never seen a young woman with such a fracture occurring spontaneously. Never. Until now. By that time, Humphreys went on, we knew she was working in the radium plant, and we were beginning to get wise to something unusual happening to these cases. But her X-rays did not show any white shadow, or anything but a fracture. It was not radium poisoning. It backed up what Dr. Flynn had told Edna when he'd examined her. While she might not be able to walk anymore, Flynn had assured